We now have some time for questions from the audience. I've got a question I want to ask, and I'm sure other people are wondering this too. I'm very greedy for your reading, for your books you write, and I'm wondering what you both are working on. What can we look forward to from you each?
Well, I'm working on a book about aging, because if anybody knows everything about it, it's me. And it's fun to write. And the research, well, the research we've done in the past was pretty strenuous, and I'm losing that ability. I mean, hoping the Tanzania thing goes well. But I'm researching myself, just watching the way I forget things. That's one of the important things about aging, as you will learn when you read my book. And so I'm very happy doing that. What are you doing?
Oh man, well, let's see. The next book of mine that's coming out is actually The Magnificent Migration, that will describe our trip together, and that's a book for younger readers. And my next big expedition after Thailand will be diving with giant manta rays in Ecuador and Peru.
Wow, I'll be looking forward to reading that. I have another question for you while we're waiting for the questions from you guys to be collected. And I'm wondering about, as a parent and an educator, as I'm sure other people out here are parents, I'm wondering how you think we can teach children how to look at animals as they go through school and kind of move away from being connected, to how to keep that connection going. So I'm curious about that.
I think if the school had animals, mice and rats, they're social animals, they're very, very interesting, incidentally. If they had an area large enough where the mice or rats or whatever animal could interact, the kids could watch them. And it takes patience. You have to be patient, because they're not going to do anything just because you're looking at them. And but you can learn a tremendous amount by just sitting and watching something for a while. I once watched a wolf for 24 hours. It was in the Arctic, so you could see all day. The sun was always up. And she slept for 9 hours, and then she went and moved her leg and went back to sleep for 9 more hours. But that, you know, that is very worth seeing. That's very worth seeing, and I saw it. So stuff like that, I mean, you should know how to watch animals. You should know they're not going to perform for you. They're going to live their lives. And if you see, that's what's interesting, to see them living their lives.
And I would add that if you can get Susie Spickle into your classroom, that's a very big help too.
Thank you. Very sweet. So here's some questions from the audience. And this was one that I saw several around this topic. It says, scientists have come around to accepting that non-human animals have emotions and consciousness. Do you think Western religions will do the same for the souls and afterlife of animals?
Don't know.
Well, I gotta say, okay, I'm a Methodist, and in my church there's a big division, but there is a movement. Certainly in the Protestant religion, I don't know what Catholicism is doing or other religions, but there's certainly a movement called creation care that says, if you care about the Creator, what better way to honor the Creator than honoring the creation? And all religions, the core of every religion seems to be compassion. And it doesn't say compassion stops at humans. I think we're in agreement.
Liz, do you have anything you want to add to that?
To add to that? Well, I think that's very good news that people are beginning to think that way. Very good news.
It's good news. Here's another kind of big question that many people asked. If you think animals have souls and emotion, what do you think about the meat industry and eating animals?
We don't eat animals.
We don't eat.
That's what we think.
Yeah,
end of story. Yeah.
I love this question. I always get this question as a naturalist, and I'm sure you get this as people who write about animals. What is your top five favorite animals?
Thurber. That's our pup.
Do you have five favorite?
Well, Thurber would be my number
one. Oh, your
dog,
right?
Yeah,
my
dog. It's kind of like, what's your favorite human being? I better say Howard or I'm going to be in trouble.
I don't, my dogs and cats, they would be, but, and Thurber too, he's a wonderful dog. I don't have favorite animals. They're all fascinating. They're different, and each is different in its own way. If they were very, very similar, you wouldn't feel that way, but you can't. It's like, what do you like better, automobiles or cattle? I mean, there's nothing to compare, and I feel that way about animals.
Yeah, what you're working on at the moment is often the thing that's occupying your heart right now. But I have got to say, getting to know octopuses was one of the highlights of my life, just because they are so different, and because they can be so affectionate, and feeling that affection from a creature so alien and so different from yourself is just, it really makes you feel at home in the world. You know what I mean? When you're around creatures who are different and people who are different, it enlarges your heart, it enlarges your moral universe, it enlarges your experience of the world by being able to touch those powers that, in the word of Henry Beston, that we have lost or never attained. So the more different a creature is from us, in a way, the more exciting and affirming it is for me. So I'm very much looking forward to getting to know giant manta rays.
Wow, me too. There's a lot of questions around this too, and I have to say there's a lot of amazing questions. I hope you will head to the back and have a chance to talk with Cy and Liz if your question isn't asked. But this is one that was common. It says, why is it so extremely difficult to persuade legislators, prosecutors, and judges to treat animals with empathy and compassion?
Because they're idiots.
True. Absolutely true. These are the folks who have a lot of power. And often, when you have a lot of power, you have the power by believing that others should not have any. And animals are the choiceless innocents. If you look at the way poor people, or people who are different in any way, people with disabilities, people who are minorities, can be treated by people in power. Just imagine how much more powerless are the voiceless animals. So I think that's part of the problem. So we all need to vote them out. And then
this might have already answered this as part of it, but this will be the last question. Why, with the changes in attitudes about animals and their consciousness, are you guys feeling hopeful about the way they are going, the way they're being treated in both wild and domestic areas?
A little. No, the people do seem to be. Some people do seem to be getting the picture. I don't suppose there's a tremendous amount of hope for wild animals in general. I've been thinking about this, and I was thinking, I'm glad I had the lifetime I had, because I saw those lions who had a relationship with people and all the things. And now lions are faced with extinction, and but my mother noticed something when she was a girl. An older man told her that, or was saying, that civilization is finished. This was at the end of maybe 1901. Civilization is finished. You know, it's done for. Everything's gone. Well, that, and his civilization may very well have been. But we all know that ours is here and we're happy, well, kind of happy with it. We were happy with it. We were happy with it. And that will be the next generation will probably adjust to whatever they're handed. And only the scientists will know that there ever was such a thing as a wild animal, but the next people will adjust. That's what I think.
Yeah, and I write a lot for kids, and I talk in the schools, as do you, Susie, and that's what gives me hope. Kids come up to me, and they get it. And I have tremendous respect for the younger generation. I think they're going to save us.
One more thing. I think it was E.O. Wilson who said that if people disappear, the Earth will readjust in a few hundred thousand years, a few thousand, maybe less. If insects disappear, the Earth is done for, which is very important to remember and casts a different light on our possible future. So.
Well, let's thank you, Cy Montgomery and Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. And a warm thanks today to the members of the audience for participating in this lively dialogue. The program next Sunday will feature Dr. Cameron Wake, research professor at UNH's Sustainability Institute, who will be speaking on climate changes in New England. You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. Stay up to date by following us on Facebook and visiting our website, www.monadnocklyceum.org.